everybody. Welcome back to episode 2 of Premeditated with Katie and
Kate.
Thank you so much for tuning in to episode 1. We've gotten some excellent feedback and we're so excited to continue sharing with all of you our passion about true crime.
I mean, it's really incredible that we just chose to do something for ourselves just to fuck around and talk about something that we happen to be passionate about. And it turned out to be
a real hit.
I don't want to say a huge hit, but
as of right now, we have 54 listens. What?
So thanks a lot. We're going to be doing part 2 of the Bonnie Garland case. And Katie, it took everything I had to not Google how this ends.
I know. And it took everything I had not to keep Googling additional information because I'm like, I already have enough to fill another hour and I don't need additional stuff. But I heard from a lot of friends who listened that they felt the same way. Like, when's the second episode going to come out? I need to know how this ends. I don't want to do any spoilers. So
good for those of you that managed to not Google.
Yes. If you Googled, you know, but you don't know everything because
you know, but you don't.
You know, but you don't. So one thing I wanted to mention before we get started, I realized in listening to episode 1 that I referenced a book, but I didn't actually tell you what the name of the book was. I put all of my sources in the notes for this episode. So whatever you're listening to this on, which exciting, we now are on Spotify and iHeartRadio and Amazon Podcasts, working on getting onto Apple Podcasts. So hopefully in the next couple of weeks, we'll be on all of the common places you might go to listen to podcasts. But yeah. Anyway, the book that I am referencing is The Killing of Bonnie Garland by Willard Galen. So sorry about that. I forgot to mention that. That's all I wanted to touch on before we get started. Should we just jump in?
Let's do it.
All right. So when we left off, where we were was Bonnie had fallen asleep. Richard had been sitting, you know, next to her, flipping through Sports Illustrated magazine and decided, I'm going to kill her.
Well, I don't know about you, but Sports Illustrated makes me want to kill.
Yeah, I mean, wouldn't have been the same if he was reading Cosmo or something like that.
Or like, you know, Popular Mechanics or yeah. Horse and Hound.
Horse and Hound. Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, Sports Illustrated, I'm like, hey, dude, nobody has abs that, like that. Like,
God, I thought that was not
murder someone.
I want to look like that. I need to kill. So all jokes aside, unfortunately, that is when he decided he was going to or he wanted to kill Bonnie.
Now, just a second. So you posted pictures of the house.
Oh, yes. Yes.
So online.
Absolutely. Start following us on Instagram. It's Premeditated Podcast. So all one word. You should be able to find us on there. But I'll be posting pictures to follow up the episodes just so you can take a look and see what does Bonnie look like? What does Richard look like? But yeah, go ahead.
Just so I get an idea and so our listeners have an idea, the picture of the house, where was Bonnie's room approximately?
Right. So they say it's on the second floor. There was a staircase that went up from the second floor to her room. So I think her room was like in the corner of the house. It sounded like a pretty unique big bedroom in a very old colonial style
like
house.
East Coast kind of.
Yeah,
oh, okay.
Exactly.
Okay. Okay. Where so, yeah. Something horrible happened.
Where something horrible will
got
be
all Amityville up in there.
So he decided he's going to kill Bonnie. And then he starts imagining how he's going to do it. He starts thinking maybe he'll slash her wrists. Maybe he will strangle her with some stockings.
That's interesting, the slashing the wrist, because if you guys will remember on our last episode, you said that he wrote a note.
That's right.
To not look like his handwriting.
Yes. That made it seem like perhaps she was going to commit suicide.
So he might have been trying to frame it in that way.
Right.
It sounds like he's really calm and collected in his thinking. Like, well, this isn't a frenzy killing
right.
spur of the moment. It was premeditated.
Dun, dun, dun,
dun, dun.
And we'll see that theme will come up throughout the trial here. So yeah, slashing her wrist was an option, strangling her with stockings. They had cookies and milk. So pure and cute
like
earlier that night.
Santa.
I know, like a murdering Santa. He was eating cookies and drinking milk. And he thought up like bludgeoning her with the mug that he drank milk out of.
Oh.
What a weird thing. Okay. But. And then he also was like, maybe I'll hit her with my guitar, which.
Whoa, what's the symbolism in that?
Right. Like, she's a singer. He played guitar.
He's going to kill her with his guitar.
Some psychologist can chime in and let us know.
You're a psych major.
What
dig into that.
Right.
Don't dig into us.
Yeah. No.
Dig into that. dig into that.
I don't want to know about myself at all. No, I just want to know.
I can already tell you this. I have daddy issues. Like, I've self-diagnosed so many times.
Oh, so he's walking throughout the house. He says, decides to putz around the house to look for a murder weapon to figure out how he's going to kill her.
He's just creeping around their house.
Again, yeah, just calmly creeping around their house. And
OG.
OG. OG, what should I murder her with is literally what he's thinking in his creepy head. So he realized, or remembered, I should say, that there was a tool shop in their basement. So he's like, there's got to be something down there to murder her with. I'm going to go down into this tool shop.
And she's just sleeping.
She's just
unaware.
Completely unaware. So he goes down, or he starts heading down the stairs, but at the you know, base of the stairs.
Entryway
to the stairs. There's a claw hammer.
Oh no.
Yeah, what? Right. And he's like, that's it. That's how I'm going to kill her. Oh. Is this claw hammer? Like, of all things, if you just decide that you're going to kill someone, who on earth decides to kill someone and then goes for like the most brutal weapon possible?
The most personal weapon.
Right. I mean, even a knife would have been less.
The knife would have been more merciful, maybe. Yeah, right. I don't know, but like there's something about a hammer.
Right.
Oh, I got the shivers.
Yeah. On his way back to Bonnie's room, so now he's got the hammer. He's decided I'm gonna hit her with this hammer. He passes by the guest bedroom. So when he stayed with Bonnie, he would stay quote unquote in the guest bedroom, but you know, after everyone goes to bed, he'd go up to Bonnie's room and then be back down in the guest bedroom before everyone woke up. So it was like
a little sneaky sneak.
A little sneaky situation. So he passed by the guest bedroom and the bed was all made. And on top of the bed was a letter. And it was a handwritten letter from Joan to Richard. And it was basically saying, like, get the hell out of here, bro.
Whoa.
It was. And so, you know, obviously not quite that close. She's like, you need to leave right now. Bonnie is going through an academic crisis and she's been through two of these before and you haven't helped her. So you just need to leave.
She's just being a mom.
I know. She's just being a mom. She's again, like we talked in the last episode, I am guessing that Bonnie went to her and was like, mom, help.
And also Joan was a sociologist.
Yeah. So that was, I told you that before we started filming here. So I should share that. I said I tried not to Google too much more, but of course I can't help myself. So I did a little bit of extra Googling and I was trying to look for pictures and I found a picture of Joan. I actually found her obituary and it mentioned that she actually got her PhD in psychology. So she became a practicing psychologist and from Yale. So she was a very educated, smart woman and she was a psychologist. So she probably saw it like, he's not right.
So
like shit ain't right
for her.
I know.
Because you have to be so careful.
Right. Right.
That's a thin line to walk. Oh gosh.
So, you know,
she's telling him, get out of here.
Yeah. Like, and when Richard described it, it wasn't like, well, that was the last straw. He just mentioned it sort of offhandedly. Like, so like he always describes stuff. He's just like, well, OG.
No emotion.
So read the letter. Heads back up to Bonnie's room and he carried the hammer up there, went over to Bonnie's side of the bed and Bonnie was laying on her side asleep facing like the outside of the bed. So when Richard was like standing next to the bed, Bonnie is asleep facing him and he like checks to make sure that she's breathing, make sure she's really sleeping.
See, that's where I'm glad that I'm a late sleeper because I can literally sense if there's someone in the room and that's terrifying to me that people that sleep, my husband would not wake up if the house was on fire and every alarm was going off.
You have said that before.
Yeah. And so that,
whereas you've got a murderous cat. That,
I do.
That breathes in your face and you're like,
oh my God. I just have to hope each and every day that I didn't like before, as I'm falling asleep, I have to remember if I did anything to piss Rosie
off.
You're
like, that's the number one thing I pray for. Like,
please. Yeah. Like, please Rosie, don't kill me in my sleep.
And you just never know.
And you don't.
You just never know. So Richard makes sure she's asleep. And then he raised the hammer above his head with both hands and brought it down on her temple.
So, and he's a big guy.
Yeah, you're right. He's a big guy. And she is average size woman. And so I am going to describe kind of what he described the injuries to look like. Richard remembers this incident so creepily well and the most minute detail, and he
just very calm,
he describes the incident and he calls it throughout the all of his interviews, he describes it I think as like the unfortunate incident.
It sounds to me like he's just well, this is what happened and this is how I did it. And also, it doesn't sound like his motive to any of his crimes was had anything to do with sex, which is often...
I will say he was super insecure. One of his biggest insecurities with Bonnie seeing other men was that he felt like he had a small penis. And he always felt like he was... I mentioned he always felt insufficient. He always felt like there were like he was less than. And he thought for sure, like, if Bonnie starts seeing another guy and sleeps with him, she's going to realize that I've got a small dick. And she's not going to want to be with me. So that does come up.
Like, she's going to have something for comparison.
And so truly, so like he was like, I always felt like my penis was smaller than everyone else's. And I'm like,
that shouldn't be enough reason to, I mean.
Well, of course it shouldn't be, but like, is a good reason? I mean.
That's interesting. So this doesn't seem like a frenzied moment of passion. One might even say it was premeditated.
Oh, premeditated. Huh.
Oh, likely. So he, okay. Okay. So.
Yeah.
He
uses
both his hands.
Yeah. And so I'm, like I said, I am going to describe the murder in pretty graphic detail. So
like
listener
discretion advised.
Yes.
Yeah.
So he hit her over the head, both hands. And he said that the second he hit her in her temple, the skin didn't break, but he said it was almost like when you push something into clay and there's like an indentation, almost like a blood blister. He said the blood started pooling up to the top and immediately her eyes rolled back in her head. She made like a guttural noise and she jerked.
I mean, well, I guess you can be thankful for small mercies.
Yeah, but you don't know. Like, it's hard to say.
Maybe
she was unconscious, but maybe she wasn't. I don't know. I'm not a doctor and I don't know what she thinks. But he said at that time he cradled her head and he like called her name.
That's weird to see if she was awake or alive.
Hard to say because once she didn't respond, he decided to keep going with his rampage.
Oh my gosh.
He hit her 3 to 5 more times, according to the medical examiner. There was blood and brain matter that flew everywhere. He later described the incident and stated that her head split open like a watermelon.
There's that completely indifferent.
And totally detached. Who uses that description?
Detached is a good, yeah. Like, he's not proud of it. He's not trying to relive it.
No.
None of that.
And
he's
his
just
description.
Like, this is what happened.
Yeah, the Dr. Galen from the book, he does lots of interviews with Richard. And it's the same
thing.
The same
thing. He is, like, he's one of those guys that's just like, or one of those people where he's just missing that part of his brain.
We'll talk more about that in a little bit because there is some interesting stuff that we're going to get into.
Do so. Okay.
So despite the brutal beating, Bonnie continued to breathe and she was alive. So Richard used the hammer then to beat her chest in an attempt to stop her heart, thinking that that would do something. He then strangled her in an attempt to quiet her. And this whole time he was really concerned about the amount of noise that Bonnie's making. So he's like, she's being really loud. Like the pounding, you know, someone's going to hear and wake up. It was a large house, but the beating and the noises from Bonnie were also loud. And he was like certain somebody was going to wake up.
But nobody did.
No one woke up. And so as Bonnie laid there gurgling and alive, but dying, Richard decided to flee. So he grabbed Bonnie's keys from her room and he made his way out of the house. Like he kind of crept out, was like quiet and made sure not to make too much noise. Cause again, he was very aware of noises he was making. So he kind of crept out and he, at that point was like, I'm going to kill myself. So I don't think I mentioned this when he made up the decision to kill Bonnie. He also had decided I'm going to kill her and myself, or that's what he says. Anyway, he says I was going to kill Bonnie and then I was going to kill myself after. So with the slitting the wrist, he thought like, I'll slit her wrist and then I'll slit mine.
He doesn't have the balls to do that.
I don't.
Like, if he doesn't feel anything, there's also a part of him that's kind of narcissistic.
Yeah.
And
he was going through different ways. Again, he was thinking through different ways to kill himself. Maybe I'll drive the car off the bridge. Maybe I'll drive up into the mountains and like drive my car off a mountain. I'll die by suicide by cop, going through all these different things. And so he just drove while he thought of different ways to kill himself. And he drove for several hours driving from Scarsdale up to Coxsackie, which is roughly 115 miles.
Can you say that again?
Coxsackie. And I should look up how to say it because
I'm like 12 years old. I actually at 12, I wouldn't even know what that was.
Honestly, I did not even catch
that. Yeah.
Coxsackie.
I'm sorry.
Oh, here we are.
God, we're
so immature, but you know what? That's the name of the place. Sorry if that's where you're from. Well, I'm probably saying it wrong too. So it's probably like French or something. It's like Coxsackie. Something fancy. But anyway, he drove about 115 miles. And he drove by a church and decided, I can't commit suicide. Because, you know, Richard was Catholic. He was raised Catholic.
Okay.
So he passed by this church and, like, took it as a sign, like, I can't kill myself.
Oh, that's convenient.
Drove a little bit further. And then he just, something in him said, I need to turn this over to someone else. I need to turn myself in. I need to tell somebody about this. But he used the phrase, like, I need to turn this over to somebody else.
He knows that Bonnie's family is going to find her eventually. So you have to think.
And like process of elimination, like, well, who was your last night that's not here?
You have to think he does feel some guilt, and he's doing that to alleviate his own, like to appease his own conscience. I don't know.
Well, so he drove by the church. He parked in front of the church and fell asleep on the church steps for about an hour or so. And about an hour later, so like 7 a.m., he knocked on the door of the church.
Okay.
So he's like, I'm going to confess. So Father Tartaglia was a parish priest at that church, and he comes to the door. Richard is standing there, and he's wearing just pants, no shoes, no shirt, because him and Bonnie were like getting ready for bed. And so Bonnie was.
So he's covered in blood.
So he's covered in blood, wearing just pants. And yeah. And at first the priest is like, oh, this guy must be like a drug addict or something. Like he's something weird is going on. And he said Richard looked super disturbed, and Richard came out and told him, like, I just killed my girlfriend and I need to turn myself in. Father Tartaglia said he looked disturbed. He wasn't hysterical at all. He was calm. Richard told him everything. Like I said, in creepy, detached detail, told him everything about what happened, stating the facts, like very matter-of-factly. And like I said, Father Tartaglia thought maybe he was hallucinating. Like, is he on drugs? Because he's like, this can't be true.
But what he is covered in blood.
Right. He's like, yeah. He's like, there must have been an accident. Like maybe he was in some sort of accident, is hallucinating, or like he said, like some drug related.
Well, it was the 70s. I mean,
yeah. And I mean, yeah. So he was just like, this can't be real. He quickly was like, no, like this guy's telling me the truth. And so Father Tartaglia said, like, what do you want me to do? You're confessing to me. What role should I play? And he said, I want to turn myself in. So I want you to call the police. So Father Tartaglia obliged and called the police. So, you know, at this time, you know, Father Tartaglia is like, is she dead? You know, is she dead? And at this point he's like, yeah. And that's when he said, her head split open like a watermelon. She's dead. She's dead. And he's like, the Garlands have found her by this time. Like, I'm sure cops are surrounding the house. You know, that's so Father Tartaglia called Chief Ronald Rea and called the police, and Chief Ronald Rea comes to the church and he speaks with Richard. Both Father Tartaglia and Chief Ronald Rea were just like, Richard is the nicest guy. And that is the vibe he gave to Father Tartaglia and to Chief Ronald Rea. Chief Rea did not want to handcuff him. Like, he was super hesitant. He's like, I don't need to handcuff this guy. He's so nice. He's so friendly. Got him a cup of coffee. Just buddy, buddy. Like, I know. Yeah. You just killed your girlfriend by bludgeoning her to death, but you seem like such a sweet guy. So
you have to wonder if part of them, like the priest and the chief, weren't like, well, I wonder what she did to piss you off, son.
Interesting. Like, you're right. Yeah, you're right. Like, it could have been that, like, yeah, I hate to
she
think
wore
that
yellow striped pajamas. Right. And they were
that slut.
Yellow she stripes. She deserved it.
Yeah. Do you know what they say about yellow stripes?
Oh my God.
No, but maybe that's true. I don't know. I hate to think that about like a priest, but you just really. So Chief Rea didn't want to handcuff him. He felt like super at ease with Richard. And once again, Chief Rea asked, like, are you sure she's dead? And Richard said, she has to be. I hit her with a claw hammer. Like, she's got to be dead. I hit her like 5 times. So Chief Rea calls the Scarsdale Police Department and says, you know, I've got a potential homicide and I need you to go to the Garland residence. Gave the address.
Right. Okay.
So a patrolman was sent to the Garland residence. And
there weren't already officers that. Okay. So it's 7 a.m. and nobody's.
So they didn't locate any like unlocked doors or anything like that. So they were like, we're going to ring the doorbell. So they ring the doorbell and Joan answers the door.
Oh my God. And her daughter, she was slept through the whole thing. How awful must you feel?
And yeah, and the police officers ask, you know, do you know a man named Richard Herron? You know, yes, I do. Is your daughter Bonnie Garland? Yes, she is. Do you know where she is right now? Is she okay? And she's like, yeah, she's upstairs sleeping. You know, like, here, I'll go get her for you. So Joan, unfortunately, goes upstairs to Bonnie's room and she found Bonnie.
She's the one that, God, that breaks my heart.
Right. And I mean, the way she described it was there was blood everywhere. Oh. Bonnie was laying on her back with her eyes open.
Unrecognizable. I'm sure.
Yeah. And I mean, blood and brain matter everywhere.
It's not
and
your daughter anymore.
She she crumbles and starts screaming. And that's when the police officers enter the residence. Bonnie was still alive.
Holy God. What? I did not. Shots fired. I did not see that coming.
She was alive. And she was lying there, staring up at the ceiling, unconscious, yeah. But staring up at the ceiling, like gasping for air. They said it sounded like she had mucus or blood in her throat. Like, and so despite the fact that her head was literally beat open, she was alive. She had been alive for at like 7 hours, eight hours.
Oh my God, that's excruciating.
So they rushed Bonnie to the hospital and she had multiple injuries to her head, her skull, her brain. She had bruising around her neck and an injury to her trachea. And since she had been bleeding for hours and hours, she like literally had no blood pressure. So she went through multiple surgeries, or I should say she went through two surgeries. The first surgery was, you know, trying to clean up her head wounds. But unfortunately, during the second surgery that evening, she did pass away.
It's probably so, better that she did.
Right. I mean, I can't imagine anyone surviving that and like having any sort of normal functioning.
Like any quality.
Yeah. Any quality of life. That's a good way to put it. So at this point in time, Richard was in jail, obviously. And immediately
dad jokes with the chief.
Right. Exactly. So immediately Richard asked to see another priest because he was like, you know, I confessed to Father Tartaglia and he did have a Catholic upbringing, and for one reason or another, he decided, like, I want to talk to a priest. So Father Peter.
Yeah.
If anyone watches Father Ted, it's like this hilarious PBS show. It's like, so that's
Father Ted.
So Father Peter Fagan. Father Peter Fagan was an assistant Catholic chaplain at Yale's Catholic Church, which was called St. Thomas More. And he was the one that immediately came to see him. So he came to the jail and talk to Richard and basically just listen to what Richard had to say. And for some reason or another, Richard had that same sort of effect that he had on Father Tartaglia and on Chief Rhea. And Father Fagan was like, this guy needs our help. This guy, like, he's a good, I can tell he's a good egg. He needs our help. So this church rallied behind Richard.
Are you serious?
I am not kidding.
You know, and maybe you go into this later on, but there, you know, that they're going to dredge up like Bonnie's relationships and how she, you know, went out with these guys. Maybe it was only like two or three guys, but they're going to say all these men that she was gallivanting around with.
100%. Yes.
Oh, victim shaming. I hate it.
So the church rallied behind Richard. Other church members started showing up to support Richard, would come visit him in jail. Father Fagan initiated the involvement of the Morehouse Church, but there were others that immediately came. One particular woman, her name was Dr. Maria Brown, and she actually mortgaged her house in order to provide money for Richard's bail.
Well, that's no different than those women that become obsessed.
Like, right. Yeah. It's like, is it like one of those people that's like, dear Richard, you sure are a hunk.
Yeah.
Like, I'll put my bill. I'll mortgage my house. Like,
yeah, there are some women out there that are like, I'm going to fix him. And
there's, I will say, I'm not sure if it's a case, but there's more than one woman in this case like that. So yeah, Father Fagan was the person who kind of initiated the involvement. And he often quoted Bible verse, they that be whole need not a physician, but they that are sick. So we don't need to take care of those that are well, we need to take care of those that aren't. And that was kind of his motto throughout all of this.
I mean, I can, yeah, but for a woman, an educated woman to like a
mortgage
priest,
her house.
Priest and like religious figures. I can see, like,
and most of the people were members of this church. I think all of them, like, I think it was all people, like, I'll get into it a little bit more, but it, this church was just, they just rallied behind Richard hardcore. So
that's unfortunate.
One of Richard's roommates from college, his name was A.T. Wall. He was part of this church as well. And so he kind of helped in working diligently in his defense. And a woman named Sister Ramona Pena, who was also a chaplain at the church, St. Thomas More Church, she really took charge of his support. Like, she became his mother figure. She was there all the time. And prior to the murder, she didn't even know Richard. They went to the same church.
Yeah.
She'd seen him at church. She knew that he played guitar. So he would play guitar for the church as well. But she said, like, I always had a good feeling about him. He always just seemed like a good kid.
Well, but that's what you said, right? Like, nobody, like, you'd let him walk you
right.
home.
Yeah, was it? Like, he's the safe guy. Everyone thought he was.
And so there's clearly he has the ability to, I would hesitate to say charm.
But that seems like his, what it is. I mean, he has the ability to, or at least slide by as a normal guy. And that he fooled,
Ted
he
Bundy.
Literally keeps fooling person after person. Yeah. Or I should say, I mean, that's what he keeps, you know, portraying. Immediately following the murder, she just said she felt sickened after hearing about the murder. She sent letters to the Garlands and to Richard. And she spoke with Father Tartaglia, who said Richard was super warm and loving. And so again, based on that, based on Father Fagan's description, she just felt this push to help Richard. So she, Father Tartaglia and Father Fagan all agreed, like, we're going to help him. So they started petitioning for Richard's bail. I mentioned that Dr. Marie Brown mortgaged her house in order to pay for his bail. The church organized and started mailing bail letters to anyone in the, everyone in the church, and then anyone else who might be interested in helping him. And the letters would discuss what was needed to be done, why they should help, what they could do. And they started collecting money for a defense fund for Richard.
Oh my gosh.
I think they saw him as like, oh, this Mexican kid that didn't have a chance.
Maybe he was
up.
Like a pet project.
Exactly.
Like, we can redeem ourselves by helping him. And
that's
indicative of the times too.
Yeah.
It's that white savior syndrome,
right?
Too.
Right.
Only it's like Catholic savior syndrome.
So after just 35 days in jail, Richard was released on bail.
Are you fucking kidding me?
He was released on bail. Yeah. This is the worst part. Sister Ramona helped find him a place to stay when he was out on bail. She searched for any Catholic schools that had divisions for troubled boys, and she contacted both of them to see, like,
he's not a boy.
So the Christian Brotherhood in Albany, New York was one of those two schools and was the only one of the two that would agree to take Richard in. The school for troubled boys took in a murderer. They claimed that, you know, they interviewed him before, and based on just like a short interview, the brothers believed that he was an intelligent young man who just needed their help.
Oh my gosh.
So LaSalle Academy, which was the school for troubled boys, took both Richard and Sister Ramona in. Several of the brothers at the school became close friends with Richard during this time. And on top of it, Richard started taking college classes and was living his best life under a pseudonym, just pretending like everything
like
with
never
Bonnie didn't happen.
Yeah.
The only reason that came out and he was like called out for that and had to stop attending classes was because the Garlands hired a private investigator to figure out where he had gone. And
how terrifying for them, because they still don't know that his motive.
100%.
And so they could be thinking, oh, he's going to come back for us. All they know is that he's out on bail.
So speaking of the Garlands, they obviously didn't respond to this response from the church well at all. They were Catholics. They were practicing Catholics. And their church was now rallying behind the man who murdered their daughter. So they described the Catholic Church's aid to Richard as the second assault.
Oh, for sure. That's a really apt description.
Yeah, I thought that was a pretty
good
way
to describe it. Because you're having to go through it all over again.
So the Garlands petitioned the cardinal to review the actions of the church of the Christian Brothers in Albany, and the cardinal didn't respond for months. So they finally did get a response like months later, but the Garlands were like, fuck you, too little, too late.
Yeah.
Like, you guys have already done way more harm than good.
It's so disrespectful, but honestly, not surprising.
So So the garlands, in addition to just basically cutting any sort of ties or relationship to the Catholic Church, they cut all ties with Yale. They felt like Yale had a duty to stand behind them. Yale had a duty to stand up for them in terms of the church that was on their campus.
Yeah.
And Yale basically like put its hands up and was like, oh, I don't want to get in the middle of this. Like, yucky.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, you're right. It is fucking yucky, but you should be like, we don't promote murder.
Yeah.
Like if you're going to stand for anyone, stand up for the victim of a murder.
Like you're still shielding him and disrespecting the garlands through your inaction.
Absolutely. And that's like, what they saw. They saw like you had a duty here. Like even if this didn't happen on your campus, but these were both Yale students. These were both people that attended your college.
Yale students.
We are like, you are our alma mater.
Yeah.
Why aren't you taking any sort of stance on this? And they were just like, sorry, yuck.
They couldn't even say like, well, of course murder is bad, but.
So Paul Garland really sort of fell apart. He had, he didn't. I think based on my research after my last episode, when I went in and just kind of wanted to see what the Garlands have been up to, it sounds like he got things back together and like him and Joan ended up having, I think, a pretty lovely life together. But the Yale community was harsh to the Garlands, which again is bizarre to me and I don't understand it, but a lot of them. So I think what happened was Paul really like went hard against Yale and was like, what the hell? Why didn't you support us? You guys had a duty. You know, I don't want anything to do with you anymore. And a lot of people who went to Yale themselves felt like, don't take it out on Yale. It's not Yale's fault. Like, why are you being such a whatever?
Well, and if you consider like the late 70s and the demographic that would be going to Yale,
right?
Like, and the faculty, and,
right?
Like, they aren't doing, you know, Habitat for Humanity. They're
exactly.
Like, they're not good.
Yeah.
But that is really discouraging.
Yeah. And there were quotes from different members of the Yale community, and almost all of them were like, Paul acted childish. He just fell apart and he acted irrationally.
So it's not so much that they're like treating the Garlands poorly out of support for Richard.
Right.
It's more like, hey, wait a minute. Don't talk to us like that.
Don't talk
it's not
about
our
my
fault.
School.
We had nothing to do with it.
Exactly. So they weren't like, they weren't in the same way that the Catholic Church was rallying behind Richard. They weren't taking that same stance. It was just more like,
they were just,
hey, we don't want to be involved in this. Don't loop us in here. Don't, you know.
Yeah. Quit talking trash. About
exactly.
It. Yeah. Okay.
Exactly. So yeah, like I said, cut ties with Yale, cut ties with St. Thomas More Church, but they also just cut ties with the Catholic Church in general. They felt that they didn't get any sympathy from the church at all, which is 100% accurate. The church, like the cardinal wouldn't even respond to them when they were like, why are you supporting the guy who murdered my, you know, 21-year-old daughter? And one of the brothers in Albany even suggested that maybe Paul was acting the way that he was because he felt guilty in that he tried to break them up and he never was supportive
because
of their marriage or of their relationship. And it's like the person who killed Bonnie was Richard.
Yeah,
it was
it's
literally
pretty clear
no
who's
one
responsible.
Else. So the trial starts in May 1978, and Richard is charged with first-degree murder. The prosecution argued that he was a cold-blooded, premeditated murder. And the prosecuting attorney, his name was William Frederick. And honestly,
wasn't
William
great.
Frederick, what is up, bro?
Like, dude, you're an attorney, so like, what? Like,
let me talk about what William Frederick did not do, which is a good job.
You had one job.
Yeah, you had one job. Yeah. And I'm going to get crap from my prosecuting attorney friends because I, in general, not a big fan of prosecutors, even though one of my closest friends is a prosecutor. But
I just watched there's a thing about Pam or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
Thing about Pam.
Oh, yeah. That prosecutor.
That
right.
prosecutor was.
That is a perfect example of why I
thumbs down.
Have a real bad taste in my mouth
yeah.
with regards to prosecutors. Anyway, if you're a prosecutor, I still love you. The work you do is necessary and I appreciate it. And I bet you're one of the good ones. So there you go. He didn't do a good job. Just to prove this point, in his cross-examination of Richard Herron, he cross-examined him for how much time do you think he cross-examined Richard for? Let's play a little game. How much time would you assume if Richard was on the stand for, like, I'm not sure how long he was on the stand
45
for.
45 minutes.
3 minutes, Kate. Three, one, two, 3 minutes.
Then you can't possibly get enough information to convince a jury to have no reasonable doubt in 3 minutes.
No, No, and the 3 minutes were just spent trying to establish that he had planned and premeditated, which is all fine and dandy. But when we talk in a second about the defense attorney's strategy, really didn't matter a whole lot.
And that prosecutor was probably thinks he's hot shit because he's trying some kind of new smooth method.
Oh, he 100% did. He also did not do a great job of telling Bonnie's story. So when I'm telling you that I don't have a lot of information about Bonnie, it's not just because the Garlands haven't shared a ton of information.
But also because none of it came out in the trial.
Because the prosecutor did not introduce any, there were notes. There were tons of notes that Bonnie wrote.
So she was just a stranger.
She was a total stranger. She was somebody that was, the defense did a very good job of showing as a sexual woman who,
oh, God, you know, forbid.
Was, right. And so she was not present at her own trial. She wasn't so a party to her own trial.
Justice wasn't done then.
So the prosecutor believed he was arguing against the insanity defense. So he thought, you know, what the defense is bringing. And this is true. The defense said he was crazy.
I truly believe that people don't want to believe that someone who comes across so normal
and so loving and caring
can be a monster, mm-hmm, and not be insane. Right. And not have a mental incapacity. Like it, right. That it's this, that's why Ted Bundy's so popular, because they're like, whoa.
He was normal.
He was totally normal. And,
or like,
and
Chris Watts, who was like a literal normal guy.
Same thing. He was so indifferent.
Right. You're right. You are so right. I just watched that documentary, and that is exactly right.
Yeah, he's completely indifferent in the documentary.
You're right. That's like a great point. But yes, it's just like comes across totally normal. And then one day it's like, snap.
Because people don't want to believe that we have the capacity to be monsters.
Right.
And we all do.
We all do. So the prosecutor thought the only thing he was arguing against was the insanity defense, but he wasn't prepared and he failed to see that the defense strategy was included a couple other things. He wanted to show, basically what the prosecutor tried to show was that Richard had planned for the attack, that he understood his actions. You know, he left quietly. He tried to avoid, apparently on the way from Scarsdale to Coxsackie, he tried to avoid tolls on the way there. So it's like, okay, he was trying to avoid being caught. Shows a little bit of like, he tried to leave quietly. He was like trying to keep her quiet. So he'd use that to try and show like premeditation as well as like planning and just like being mentally aware.
Right. Not insane.
Right.
Maybe chemically imbalanced, but not insane.
The defense attorney was a man named Jack Lippman, young guy, prominent attorney at the time. And even he continues to practice, is still a well-known attorney.
Well, if the freaking Vatican paid for his defense. Right,
exactly. Like, which is, perhaps did. They went down into the vault in the Vatican, you know, the Da Vinci Code, and they're like, what goods can we pawn for Richard Herron's defense?
Let's sell the Shroud of Turin.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, like how much will that 1,200-year-old piece of paper bring at auction? Can we sell that?
Don't we have Jesus's underwear here somewhere? Let's get rid of that.
That should be good.
That should fetch a few million.
So he argued not just, you know, argument one was that Richard was insane at the time of the murder, so not responsible based on insanity. But as a backup, he argued that he was suffering from extreme emotional disturbance at the time of the killing.
Well, so, I can't argue with that.
Right. So extreme emotional disturbance, according to the statutes in New York, is a mitigating factor for murder, which means it brings the murder charge immediately from murder to manslaughter. So he was either going to try and prove that he was insane, but he's like, well, shit, even if I don't get that, I'm still going to be able to get manslaughter if I just prove extreme emotional disturbance.
Yeah, I can buy the extreme emotional disturbance. If I'm a juror, I think I'd buy that.
So those were the two defense strategies, whereas the prosecutor only focused on the insanity.
Yeah, no strategy.
He only focused on insanity. He's like, of course I can show that he wasn't insane because of all of these things, but he did nothing to prove that he wasn't suffering from extreme emotional disturbance. So he left that side wide open for attack and for...
Did he just not see that ball coming to the outfield?
Because you get lots of documents pre-trial to,
yeah, you know,
to put things forth. And like, he would have known what the defenses were. He would have known what the strategy was.
He probably just thought he had a slam dunk.
I think he did. I think he was like, well, it's clear that this guy wasn't insane and just stopped there. But so, yeah. So he claimed that Richard was suffering from a mental defect that was kind of similar to PTSD due to their breakup. He said, you know, there wasn't a motive, and that in and of itself shows that Richard's state of mind wasn't right, because no sane person, no person in their right mind would just decide to kill somebody out of the blue.
But technically, do you agree with this? If you're saying that someone's insane, to me, that's saying that they are irrational and incapable of making clear and conscious right decisions 100% of the time.
You could argue that it's at the time of the incident.
So like, you can say someone's completely insane, but just for a moment.
Yeah. I mean, the standard is like, they can't know that, like,
they don't have to have an established pattern of behavior. I mean, Richard does.
It could be like, you're completely normal and then you snap, but they have to prove that, like, during the time of the incident, you had no way of knowing what you were doing. You didn't know, like, the effect it would have. You're completely insane. So a crime of
passion, if I got, you know, angry at someone and ran them over with my car.
No, but that, I mean, you might have passion there, but you knew what you were doing. Even if you were like so angry that you were like seeing red, you knew what you were doing. Like you knew.
So in that case, they can't plead insanity.
Yeah, no, that wouldn't be. That would just be like a crime of passion, which would be like manslaughter.
So the thing that makes Richard's case different than that then is because he has this so-called PTSD.
Yeah, so that's one of Jack Lipman's, one of the defense attorneys.
So he was emotionally incapacitated.
And they said, so what Jack said was like, during the time that Bonnie was gone on her Glee Club tour between May 7th and when she returned and when she was murdered on July 7th, Richard was a victim because he waited and waited and Bonnie didn't return any of his letters or anything. So during that time, he just like slowly fell into this incapacitated state where he just was going. He just
like he had no free will.
Exactly. And again, the prosecutor didn't touch at all on the emotional disturbance aspect. He did a little bit, but basically just stuck to like, well, Richard doesn't show any emotion, so there can't be extreme emotional disturbance because there's like no emotion at all. So that's like it's a catch 22, right?
And like, you can't have PTSD affect your emotions if you don't have any emotions.
Exactly. So that's what the prosecutor tried to argue. And then he also said, like, just because an act is irrational or abnormal doesn't mean someone is suffering from extreme emotional disturbance, which is a fair point. Like, yeah, that's absolutely right. Just because you can't really explain why somebody did something doesn't mean that they were emotionally disturbed. It might means something else. I don't know what, but so one of the interesting things about this, and I'm going to loop back to the day Richard was getting his truck fixed before he took the flight up to see Bonnie.
Right.
There were two books that he read. One of them was about
Sybil.
Yeah. One was Sybil, dissociative identity disorder. One of them was about using psychiatry in your defense. And
oh my, mind blown. Right.
And so
I forgot about that.
Yes. And so that's exactly what Richard did. The defense brought in some heavy hitters in terms of psychologists to try and pick apart what the hell was wrong with Richard.
That is master manipulation.
Right. And it's like, sure, could it be a coincidence that he was reading a book about using psychology in your defense for murder? No. So the defense called two psychiatry witnesses, Dr. John Train and Dr. Mark Rubenstein. So Dr. John Train examined Richard for a total of 9 hours over the 3 weeks after the murder. And like I said, Richard only ever would refer to it as the incident in question. So he never would be like,
he's distancing himself.
Right. Yeah. Just like so bizarre. So Dr. Train concluded that Richard had suffered a transient situational reaction in which it indicated an adult adjustment problem. So what that means is he said Richard had become dependent on his partners, like was the case with Ginny and with Bonnie.
And his mother.
Right. Yeah. And he felt the loss of Bonnie was going to be a loss of himself. So he felt by losing Bonnie, he was losing himself. There was this symbiotic relationship.
I can agree with that. He's totally dependent.
Right. And when Bonnie decided, like, we're not going to be together, he almost felt like a split in his personality.
Probably. I would buy that.
And so, yeah. So similar to like a schizophrenic is what Dr. Train said.
And the fact that he's calling it the incident that occurred, or however he says it.
And so this whole time you're wondering, like, is this an act, or is it really that
those are Richard the ones that are terrifying?
Crazy. I don't know. So Dr. Train said that what Richard had experienced was a significant loss of his capacity to know or appreciate what he was doing was wrong, which would be insanity.
But so he cradled her head and called her name
and crept out of there. And just everything, like, there's so many things, like everything leading up to it and how he just like, oh, I'm going to kill her. And then like finds the right murder weapon. And the defense's argument one was that he was insane. But if that didn't work, he was suffering extreme emotional disturbance. So he was trying to kind of hit both of those. So Dr. Train hit the first one saying he was insane. Dr. Rubenstein spoke with Richard again a couple of times within a few weeks after the murder. And he said that Richard was suffering some sort of like significant neurosis. He said the way that he spoke about Bonnie's murder with creepy clarity, it almost was like super cognitive. Like he could remember, like, again, the phrase, which I hate to repeat, but her head split open like a watermelon. Like who says that? And it is so, that is a very clear image of what he saw.
Yeah.
And how
the imagery is very graphic. And again, it brings me back to, he's not bragging. He's not trying to relive anything, you know, but he's not bragging.
He's just simply stating, like, as if I'd be telling you like about my day at work. Like, yeah, I walked into my office and I sat down at my chair and I turned on my computer and he's like, yeah, I hit the hammer to her temple and it turned purple and just like so bizarre. So he also stated that he seemed so emotionless about the act itself, which he just found repulsive, and he didn't have any empathy. Like didn't care about Bonnie, didn't care about Bonnie's family.
He's not capable of empathy.
So he thought that Richard's cognitive capacity had been severely impaired. And he said, this is proven by the fact that he has like literally no contrition for his actions like that.
But I don't like how they're saying that Bonnie breaking up with him is the catalyst to his losing his mind. Like I agree with the emotional disturbance, but it clearly started before Bonnie.
Right.
So how is it her fault?
Oh God, no. I mean,
it's just disgusting how they're pushing it on her.
Right.
It's like, if he'd never met her, he would have never done this. Yeah. He fucking would have.
Yeah. He just would have done it with somebody like Jenny
or
Bonnie too, or whoever.
Or someone cut him off in traffic and he's going to, like who knows? This guy's completely unpredictable.
Right. So in addition, the prosecution called a couple of witnesses, Dr. Daniel Schwartz and Dr. Abraham Halpern. So Dr. Schwartz was called by the prosecutor, but he actually ended up helping the defense a great deal. She's like, great job, prosecutor. Did you prep this guy or what? Again, just
was
big old. So he diagnosed Richard with depersonalizations, meaning he had difficulty recognizing things about himself or others. He said that it's not a disease or a defect, but it's a symptom of one.
Okay.
And said he could tell there was definitely something wrong with Richard, but it wasn't extreme emotional disturbance. He's like, it's something. There's something not right.
The boy ain't right.
Yeah, that boy ain't right. But it's not extreme emotional disturbance. However, he said it's not a disease or defect, but rather a symptom of one. And the jurors are like, well, if there's a symptom of something, like something's wrong. Like you don't have a symptom without a disease. You don't have a symptom without a sickness. So they took it to mean like there's something wrong. And even if he's not like mentally ill, or even if he's not insane, there's something wrong. And so they took that as like, he must be like emotionally disturbed. So the second psychiatrist for the prosecution was on the stand for literally a handful of minutes, and half of that time, literally like two pages of testimony, and half the time was spent going over his credentials. Like literally it's like, I'm a doctor and blah, 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 blah. And yeah, that's about, and all he said was his conclusion is based on, or the conclusion that he had was that Richard hadn't suffered from psychosis. He was like, you know, I'm a doctor, and Richard has not suffered from psychosis. And it was really just like that. He said, this is based on my observation that Richard did a good job sneaking out of Bonnie's house. He was aware of making sure to keep quiet. And he said, if he was crazy at the time, he wouldn't have cared about all the noise that he was making. He would just make it, which, okay, fair point. But you testified for like 14 seconds. So again, not enough time when this trial is days long and you're like a snippet of that, jurors are going to forget.
Yeah.
And they did. So a couple of other key things that were witnessed by the jury or by psychiatrists or attorneys or the author of this book, Dr. Galen, with regards to Richard, they said he had a very hard time recognizing when he was angry. Like we've talked a lot about how Richard didn't get angry. And but not only did he just not get angry, he also had a really hard time recognizing if he was sad or angry. So Dr. Galen, in interviewing him at one point, noticed Richard was crying. I can't remember what they were talking about, but Richard started tearing up and he's like, oh, why are you tearing up? What's going on? And Richard's like, I'm not.
Oh,
and Dr. Galen's like, but you are. I see tears like in your eyes. Yeah. And he's like, oh, no, I'm not sad. I just like my eyes are, I'm not sad. So there was another situation where Dr. Galen asked George, like, hey, can you list off in this previous week, can you tell me what emotions you felt this week? And Richard paused for several minutes.
Oh, that's uncomfortable.
He literally couldn't think of any emotions. Like, I don't know. Kate, tell me about, just name some emotions that you felt.
Rage, depression.
Right.
Like anxiety.
Right. Like happy, sad, that's angry, 24/7. Frustrated.
Yeah.
Anyone, like we can all name emotions. Maybe not, like even if it's not emotions you felt today, you could go, I could list 10 emotions for you right now.
Oh, for sure.
He couldn't list any. And Dr. Galen like really pushed him on this and was like, what do you, like, you really can't think of a single one? And he's like, well, I don't really know what you mean by emotions. After all of those pauses and the pushes by Dr. Galen, after explaining everything, he said, is tolerant an emotion? And Dr. Galen is like, suppose so. And he's like, I guess I just feel tolerant.
That's like,
okay, crazy.
Description, like,
after everything, you're like, you're right. You are just tolerant. This doofy guy who just like tolerates.
But clearly life. Not.
Yeah, right. Until he kills someone.
He tolerates it until he doesn't. And then it's like it's one extreme to the other.
Right. And so he's just like, just aloof, just sort of floats by like, I'm going to go to Yale.
Or I'm a murderer.
Right.
Murderous.
Yeah. Right.
Like,
so just.
That's terrifying.
So that was pretty much the prosecution and defense. They relied heavily on psychiatry. And the verdict took 4 days of jury deliberations. And they ultimately found Richard not guilty of murder, but instead guilty of manslaughter. So they bought into the extreme emotional disturbance.
I can't honestly argue with that. Like,
I think I need to, and I should have done this. I should have dove into extreme emotional disturbance a little bit more to figure out like what are the prongs to determine if you are suffering from extreme emotional disturbance. I can't say one way or another.
Our listeners have Google. So.
Right. We can probably figure out what the statute looked like. Actually, I could just go into
if you
Westlaw,
don't have Google,
find what the statute looked like then, but I don't know what.
So did he go to an institution?
So the maximum allowable sentence for manslaughter was 8 1/3 years to 25 years in prison. So it would be like minimum of 8 1/3 years, maximum 25 years in prison.
Okay.
And Richard was sentenced to the maximum. Now you'd think Richard would be like, yep, I killed someone. I should go to prison now. But no, that's not how he reacted. He was like, woo-hoo, I'm upset. So Richard and the Catholic Church were very upset by the verdict. Not just like, take it and go to jail or go to prison for 8 1/3 to 25 years after bludgeoning a woman to death. Take it. Think about your life. Think about what you've done and hopefully get out at the end of it a better person than you went in. But instead he's like, just doesn't seem fair.
Well,
you know what's not fair? Bonnie having to die.
Yeah.
Bonnie's family not having a child.
And losing her life very slowly.
Right.
Not having a merciful death.
Exactly.
Of any kind. Complete torture for her family. I mean, and you think about murder in general, and it reaches so far beyond the victim.
Right.
It's the victim's family. It's, you know, oh, I was
all of Bonnie's friends.
All of Bonnie's friends.
Bob.
It touches so many lives.
Yeah. I don't think I mentioned it, but she had two brothers and a sister. And I'm like,
you're almost defined by that.
Yeah.
For the rest of your life.
Right.
So he did 25 years.
So he was sentenced 8 1/3 years to 25 years in prison. Richard felt like a year, maybe two, would have been sufficient.
That's his narcissism.
Right.
Yeah.
He said, and I quote, they shouldn't require more of me. I've given them so many months or so many years. I don't know what they want of me. It's sad what happened, but it's even sadder to waste another life.
It's sad what happened. Not it's sad that, what I did.
That I murdered somebody.
Yeah. He's still not accepting responsibility.
So the prosecutor, like after hearing the verdict, was like, shucks, that's too bad. Like, oh, gee, that's too bad. He just really was like, I can't believe this happened. And everyone's like, you suck.
Yeah.
The Carlins are leaving. And they're like, you're the worst. You suck.
Well, yeah. You win some, you lose some.
I know, right? Like, I know. But Attorney Lippman, like I said, I mean, he practices still to this day.
Sounds like a remarkable attorney.
Yeah, he did a great job. I have nothing but respect for defense attorneys, even if sometimes things like this happen because it's in order for our system to work. They have to be there. They have to present a good defense. Everybody deserves it. It's in our constitution.
Yeah, definitely.
I should say, you know, same thing about prosecutors. They We got to have them too, which just have some feelings. So
now.
Attorney Littman tried to keep Richard on bail after the verdict to give a final goodbye to his family and friends. Because remember, Richard was out on bail until he was sentenced. So throughout all of, you know, basically 35 days after the murder until he was found guilty. So that day he had to go to jail.
Right.
But so he had been out of prison. And so Attorney Littman was like, you know, let him have a final goodbye with his family and friends. But the judge who sentenced him to the maximum after all of this was just pissed and was like, don't try and pull at my heartstrings. No, like he's going to jail. Shut up.
Yeah. I realize the judge's hands aren't completely tied when a jury decides something like that.
No, they're not. But I think in this case, I mean, it has to be a really...
Like the prosecution would have to present such a believable case that...
Yeah. A judge can overturn a jury's verdict, but it has to be like... And I'm actually... It might be state by state, so I'm not sure if that's the case in all states. So anyway, so Richard prison sentence. He was in prison until January 1995. So he served 18 years in prison. He was denied parole 5 times between 1978 and 95. And at that time, parole was granted. Who knows what he showed or what he did. I couldn't find anything as to why he was granted parole. But during his time in prison, this is kind of a fun tidbit, he decided to turn against the Catholic Church and became radicalized. He embraced his Spanish heritage and fought for prisoner rights and abused minorities and really just like turned his back on the Catholic Church entirely.
He got everything he needed out of them.
Right. And he just became bitter. Like he would talk all the time about like, I shouldn't be in here. And like, dude.
Yeah.
Like,
no, it's and no, probably the, used his manipulation and charm, if you can call it that, for parole as well.
Right. Well, at least he served. I mean, he could have served as little as 8 1/3 years. So thank God he was at least in prison for 18. But geez, Louises. So after Richard's sentencing with regards to the Catholic Church, Father Fagan left the church, got married. Sister Ramona was fired from her chaplaincy. She was fired from that church. So she was done with her chaplaincy with Yale and St. Thomas More Church. And it was she never got a reason why she was fired, but she just had a feeling and she asked the priest, like, why are you doing this to me? What is the reason? And he wouldn't give her an answer. So she never got an answer, but she still to this day, or I should say to this day. Yeah. This book was written like in the early 80s, I think, but she believed in Richard. She believed in helping him. She didn't regret it. She felt like it was part of what she was meant to do.
The world needs people like that.
Yeah. And you know, it's
God bless her.
So after trial, Paul Garland, Bonnie's dad, just found the verdict to be a complete injustice. His voice was cracking outside of the courtroom. He was just really bummed out, obviously. And they ended up, the Garlands actually sued Richard for emotional distress caused by the murder of Bonnie. The recovery was granted by the trial court. It was reversed on appeal. The statute didn't allow for recovery for emotional trauma, they found, but they did end up settling for like $40,000. But the Garlands said that they just wanted to establish a precedent
no amount of money that can.
Right. And I mean, they didn't need the money. And they said that they're like, this is not about the money. They said that they were just establishing the principles and the precedent for the rights of victims of crime. So they were just
for
like,
me, it would totally be about the money.
You're like,
I would be like
it's not about the money at all.
But I at least want to get like, if I'm going to have to live with the knowledge that he did this for the rest of my life.
But you're not going to get anything. Like it got $40,000 out of his like,
right,
3 cent an hour job that he makes in prison. You know, like you might get checks. I'm trying to, somebody was telling me that their some family member of theirs was a victim of some serious fraud. The guy got sentenced to prison and every so often they receive like a $28 check or something, which is their part of the settlement
that
they received.
Well, they just don't send it at all. It's like, because it's just a reminder.
I know. And so they're like, they also sold their home in Scarsdale and they moved to Connecticut.
Oh, heck yeah, you'd sell that house.
I know. Something was on my list of things to do, look up the house and see like what's up with it.
Every once in a while, I look up the Amityville house. What's really interesting is on Google Earth, it's blurred out.
What?
Yeah. If you look up the address of the Amityville house.
Okay, no, thanks.
It's blurred out.
I don't want to do that. I'm not looking.
But I did see a sales listing for it, and it's a really pretty house.
Look, I'm considering.
I mean, I don't know.
No.
Yeah.
I sage the shit out of that house first. Some sage.
Run your fireplace.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Get like one of those flamethrowers that just like stuff sage in there. You're like,
oh, that's amazing.
So I also found Joan's obituary, and it says they moved to Connecticut. Then they moved, I think, to Arizona, and then they ended up in Florida. So they moved all over the place. She opened a psychiatry practice. So I think that this was probably a real dark spot. I mean, it was obviously a very dark spot in their lives, but yeah. I think that they were able to rebuild. And
that's pretty impressive too, because, you know, a lot of families, that just completely shatters them.
So after prison, you know, he got out of prison in 1995, Richard moved to New Mexico to live with a female friend who he started talking to while in prison. Richard began working as the head of a department of the New Mexico Traffic Safety Bureau to help stop residents from being injured or killed in traffic incidents. So he started working for the state.
What the fuck?
Right. It's like, who hired this guy? Did you not do a background check? Because this is terrible. And so around, I think it was 97 or so, there was an article that came out because people found out about this and were like, that's fucked up.
Yeah. Like,
he's in charge of protecting people from being killed, and he literally bludgeoned a woman to death. So they let him keep his job. They're like, he's doing a great job and we have nothing but great things to say about him. And it's completely irrelevant.
Well, yeah, every employer would love to have someone that has no emotions.
Exactly.
Like, yeah. Like,
exactly.
Oh, you're already dead inside. Yeah. I don't have to do it for you.
You're hired. Yeah. Can you start now? So I looked up to see what happened after that. That's kind of the most recent thing I could find about Richard was 1997. I did find somebody named Richard Herron who lives in New Hampshire. Maybe it's him. I was very tempted to be like, you murderer.
New Hampshire, watch out.
Right. I mean,
you live in New Hampshire.
The long and short of it, Richard got off essentially with manslaughter.
For 18 years. He only
spent
served
18
years
in jail for literally the most gruesome murder, the most gruesome way to murder somebody with the most unemotional response. And he's out living his best life while Bonnie's been dead now for 40 years-ish.
And there are guys that are still in prison for having pot on them in the 80s. Like,
this is where we live.
This is the American justice system.
Well, guys, that is the end. I should say the end of Bonnie Garland's unfortunate story.
Yeah, yeah. And if you guys happen to pick up any other information about it that we did not cover, definitely feel free to share.
Right. And if you know of, you know, if you are familiar with this case, if you know where Bonnie lived, if you are connected to it in any way.
Or if you live in New Hampshire.
If you live in New Hampshire, let us know.
Yeah.
Keep safe, because if you know someone named Richard Herron,
yeah,
and he has a hammer, yeah. I would just not trust that man with the hammer.
I wouldn't trust any man with a hammer. All right, guys, until the next episode, thank you so much for listening.
Yeah, thank you for listening. We're excited for Kate to take the wheel next week.
And tell your folks we says hi.